times. Who can forget Clint Eastwood speaking to an empty chair at the Republican National Convention back in the summer of 2012?
So I've got Mr. Obama sitting here, and I just was going to ask him a couple questions.
Eastwood went on to criticize the invisible President Obama about his policies when this happened.
I'm not going to shut up. It's my turn. So anyway, we're going to have to have a little chat about that. And then I just wondered all these promises. And then I wondered about what? What do you want me to tell Romney? I can't tell him to do that. That can't do that to himself. You're absolutely crazy.
Well, that was a weird and awkward use of the empty chair routine that came from improvisational theater and from some of the theories of J.L. Moreno, the father of psychodrama. Our guest is his son, John Moreno, who's written a book about his father called Impromptu Man, J.L. Moreno and the Origins of Psychodrama, Encounter Culture, and the Social Network. He's the David and Lynn Silfen University Professor of Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a member of the UNESCO International Bioethics Committee and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. It's been a couple of years, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Lovely to be with you, Marty.
Well, we were both cringing as we were listening to Clint Eastwood used that chair at the Republican convention. And we were watching that yesterday on TV, and I was just thinking, you know, wrong place, wrong time to use the empty chair routine.
Well, it was fascinating to me because I saw him using the empty chair. I went to bed, and after about 10 minutes of lying awake, I got up and said, I got to write something about this. Because I grew up with this technique. My dad was a psychiatrist who, at least as early as 100 years before that moment at the Republican convention, was using the empty chair as a technique in spontaneity theater with children, with his cast of soon-to-be-famous actors in Vienna, and ultimately in psychotherapy. And the empty chair has now become a routine part of psychotherapy.
Help us understand, and I do want to talk in much more detail about your father, but I think when I told people today we're going to be talking about, you know, the origins of psychodrama, I have to say a number of people kind of scratch their heads saying, what is psychodrama?
What is that? Right.
I grew up in the 60s, so I know what psychodrama is. Explain that to our listeners.
Well, you know, it's funny. The word psychodrama has become almost a word that op-ed people like to use when they write something, the psychodrama of the Obama presidency, the psychodrama of this, the psychodrama of that. There's something about the word that sort of fascinates people. It's the combination of psychology and drama. But when my father thought of the word, he thought of it as a response to psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. He was a medical student at the University of Vienna. And one day, Sigmund Freud gave a lecture to the medical students, probably around 1914. And it was a dream analysis. And after the lecture, Freud, so the story goes, went past the medical students, almost all young men, of course, and got to my father and said, "So, Moreno, what are you doing?" And so my father is supposed to have said, "Well, Professor Freud, I begin where you leave off." And Freud said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you destroy people's dreams by analyzing them. Mm. I give them the courage to dream again." And the idea of psychodrama is the idea of putting into action, dramatizing, externalizing in action, in drama, in theater, the feelings that we have inside. That's the basic idea of psychodrama.
You quote some more in your book. This is what your dad supposedly or probably or some version
perhaps
of this said to Sigmund Freud. "You meet people in the artificial setting of your office, and I meet them on the streets and in their homes in their natural settings." And I guess, he was really sort of drawing a bit of a line in the sand between how he thought of human beings, perhaps their troubles, how the mind works.
Yes, he didn't believe, as Freud did, that somehow all of our problems are as a result of neurotic complexes. He actually thought that human beings are basically good, that platonic love is not only possible but common. And he thought that spontaneity and creativity were the two greatest principles of human beings. And this was part of his mysticism. He said God is spontaneity. Hence, the commandment is be spontaneous, which people have had fun with. How can you tell somebody to be spontaneous?
Exactly.
He actually believed that we could train people in theater to be more spontaneous, which, if you think about it, is what many actors do. with theater games and method acting and so forth. He thought that in the case of God, whether you believe or not, his idea was that the most spontaneous thing that had ever happened was the creation of the universe, and the most spontaneous and creative thing. And he said, this is the godlike part of us, that we can be spontaneous and creative. A problem is that as we grow up, the forces of society and our own difficulties cause us to be less spontaneous and creative in our lives.
So going back to the chair, and that, this is a part of psychodrama, the kind of therapy that he did. How was that? How did he envision that, and how was that supposed to work?
So, for example, he might set up a chair at the beginning of a psychodrama session and say, all right, now, everybody, who is in this chair for you? It could be your...
This is the empty chair,
the
right?
Empty chair. Who is in this chair? Now, for Mr. Eastwood, it was Barack Obama, but it could be a parent. It could be a child. It could be a teacher. It could be a boss. It could be somebody with whom you have a conflict, or somebody with whom you have unfinished business who, for some reason, you can't talk to anymore, somebody who's dead. It could also be somebody who's never been born, a future child, a future spouse. Talk to that person in the chair. Now, become the person in the chair. This is what Clint Eastwood didn't do.
Which was to sit in the chair.
Exactly,
right?
To reverse roles with the president. If he had reversed roles with the president, he would have started to see these issues from the president's point of view. Now, that doesn't mean they would have ended up agreeing, but that was the sense in which it was a failed empty chair exercise.
I do want to talk more about your father, but you do begin, you're his youngest child.
Yes.
And his third wife was your mom.
That's correct.
And you were, I did the math here, I think about, he was about 63
when
you were
born.
He
was 63 when I was born.
Right. So this, and you call him JL in the book. You don't say my dad,
People have remarked on that, but to me, it wasn't anything I had to think about, because first of all, he liked to be called JL. That was the... It was Jacob Levy Moreno. He was born Jacob Levy. He changed his name around. Mm-hmm. He liked to be called J.L., if anything, or the doctor, or God.
Yes, we'll
he liked that too.
We'll get to that.
But also, I wanted to have a certain intellectual detachment from him. I wasn't going to write a 300-page book in which I keep saying dad, dad, dad. And I thought it was more frankly, professional that way to call him J.L.
You grew up, he was a doctor, or I guess a psychiatrist at a mental institution. You grew up on the grounds of this institution. I mean, it didn't seem like a snake pit that we think of.
No, it wasn't. I mean, this was about a 30 or 40 bed small sanitarium, as they would call them in those days. He created in 1935 the Beacon Hill Sanitarium in Beacon, New York, near Poughkeepsie. And these were the days before medication. Really what you had was situational therapy, milieu therapy, and he had everybody there. He had drug addicts, he had florid psychotics, he had older people with dementia. You didn't make these categorizations the way institutions do now, or diagnoses even are made now. And everybody was part of psychodrama therapy at this. And I grew up there. I was born in 52, and I consorted with the patients. It was a 20-acre facility, and it was pretty hard to keep a little boy away from everybody. And so I like to say some of my earliest friends were drug addicts and psychotics, and those were the doctors. You really sometimes couldn't tell, which was one of the funny things about these institutions, you know. And my father liked that. He, for example, he would put a woman in a white nurse's uniform, a patient, female patient in a white nurse's uniform. He'd call a patient doctor. He would elevate everybody. These days we reduce everybody. Oh, everybody should be Mr. and Ms. Well, let's elevate them, because they play in playing a role that's recognized by society. That's therapeutic, and that gives them a sense of responsibility.
You also did some of this psychodrama. It sounds like as a kid as well.
As a kid, and also when I was a little older, for a while I was a psychodrama trainer. It's not my temperament to be a psychotherapist. I finally decided that, but. I obviously get a lot of insight, and it gave me tremendous insight in what my father was trying to do.
And what was his interest in theater? Because he seemed to be, I mean, he had an interest in psychiatry, I guess, in his kind of formal aspects, but he did have this intense interest in theater.
Interestingly, he did not intend at first to be a psychiatrist. He was trained to be an anesthesiologist at one point. This is 19-teens in Vienna during the First World War. But he was never influenced particularly by psychology. He was influenced by the theater.
Right.
And in Vienna at that time, the theater was everything. It was like baseball and the NFL today. Everybody was talking about theater. So he decided to start a theater, what he called the Theater of Spontaneity, And the idea of the theater spontaneity is that everybody should play their own roles. He wanted to destroy the playwright, the most radical possible position you can take in theater. And he had some very famous cast members, ultimately. In particular, he discovered Peter Lorre. And Peter Lorre at that time was an 18-year-old cadging for change in the cafes where everybody was hanging out, claimed that he had been kicked out of his house for impregnating the family maid. It was a good story. In truth, his father reluctantly let him try acting. His name was Laszlo Lowenstein.
Oh, wow.
My father thought he was adorable. He tried him in some what he called spontaneity tests. He then said, you can be part of my cast. And he changed his name to Peter Lorre. And Lorre then developed a creepy character that
I worked, can hear that voice.
It worked so well for him, right? In Casablanca and in M, the Fritz Lang, 1931 Fritz Lang movie. It worked so well for him that he never gave it up. And my father warned him that he really needed to find another character or he would be typecast. And indeed, that's exactly what happened.
But did your father think of then theater as a form of therapy, therapy as a form of theater? How did he see the connection between the two?
You know, this is all really created trouble for him as he went on because he never saw a distinction between theater and therapy.
Yeah.
So in the case of some of his actors actually also became patients in many ways because he would find roles for them that he thought they needed to play to enhance their spontaneity and creativity. Now, he brought that idea from Vienna to New York, and he worked with the group theater in 1930 at Carnegie Hall, and he created his own impromptu theater. But he always had a problem. It's sort of like the problem Clint Eastwood had. Improvisational theater is not like regular theater because there's no dramatic arc to it. You know, it gets bumpy and disorganized, and you get a little frustrated. It also challenges the audience. So finally he decided even his actors, like Peter Lorre, were unable to get out of their roles. But if he could take it into psychiatry, you know, then he could help mental patients find new ways of behaving. And that was finally the kind of compromise he made.
Well, we're almost up on a break here, but so he thought of people as sort of acting out role, whatever sort of designated role they had. That was the role that they were playing in their life.
Yes, but he said we're constricted by the roles we play. Also, so he liked to take people into what he called surplus reality. Well, this is the way you are normally are with your mother, or you're with your daughter, or with your son, or your dad. Let's try a different way of approaching this situation. And you have the safety of doing that in the psychodrama theater that you can't do in ordinary life. And other therapists then help you to work out these new roles.
That's Jonathan Moreno. We're talking about his father, J.L. Moreno, the father of psychodrama. And our guest is the author of a new book. It's called Impromptu Man. And again, subtitled J.L. Moreno and the Origins of Psychodrama, Encounter Culture, and the Social Network. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. Give us a call. Any questions or comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Allentown Symphony Orchestra supports WHYY and presents Beethoven No. 5 on Saturday, November 1st at 8 p.m. and Sunday, November 2nd at 3 p.m. First performed in Vienna's theater in 1808, it is one of the best-known compositions in classical music and most frequently played symphonies. Also on the program, Elgar's Concerto for Cello, featuring Matt Heimovitz, nominated for 2 Juno Awards. More at MillerSymphonyHall.org. That's MillerSymphonyHall.org.
Supporting WHYY, the Cooper Neurological Institute offers a full range of neurological and neurosurgical interventions, including minimally invasive brain surgery and complex spinal procedures. From epilepsy, migraine, and movement disorder care to Leksell Gamma Knife Perfection Technology and neuro-oncology services, Cooper provides access to specialists at 10 locations in South Jersey and Pennsylvania. For a consultation, cooperhealth.org/CNI or 856-968-7965.
The Catholic Foundation of Greater Philadelphia supports WHYY. The Catholic Foundation believes that at the heart of charity is love, but that there also needs to be efficiency. The Foundation exists to provide a single source through which loving people can make sure that their generosity is doing the most good possible. More information is available at 215-587-5650 or online at CatholicFoundationPhila.org. 215-587-5650 or CatholicFoundationPhila.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you're just joining us, our guest is Jonathan Moreno. He is a university professor of ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, also a member of the UNESCO International Bioethics Committee, and he's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, the author of several books, including a new one about his father, J.L. Moreno, called Impromptu Man. And again, to join our conversation, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscoane. Especially interested in hearing from folks that work in the field of psychiatry and psychology about what you make of some of the ideas of J.L. Moreno. Jonathan, I just wanted to quote something that your dad said. This is about this combination of theater and psychiatry. He says, it was easier to advocate 100% spontaneity in a therapeutic theater. The aesthetic imperfections of an actor on stage could not be forgiven by his audience, but the imperfections and incongruities a mental patient shows on the psychodrama stage are not only more easily tolerated, but unexpected and often warmly welcomed. Why was it important, do you think, for someone to have an audience as they sort of act out the drama of their life?
Well, he thought that there's something very odd about one-on-one psychotherapy. Not only is it kind of inefficient, but also, you know, we may have many, many different people in our lives who fulfill different things that we need. And so why not have a group where you can choose different people who can help you in different aspects of your problem rather than rely on only a single person? So, for example, one of his famous cases was a case of Adolf Hitler during the Second World War. It was a butcher in New York City who thought he was Adolf Hitler. And so his wife brought him in, and sure enough, he had a little mustache. And my father said, well, Herr Hitler, how are you? Good to see you. Let's go into the psychodrama theater. And he introduced him to therapists, one who played Eva Braun, one who played Himmler, one who played Goebbels. And they acted out the dramas of the front page of World War II on the psychodrama stage, until finally he decided he'd had enough. He had satisfied what my dad called his act hunger. He played this role, and all right, that was enough. It was sufficient. Now, was he ever normal in some sense? No, he didn't. But he was at least functional.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't,
think he was Adolf Hitler?
And he didn't seem to need to play the role of Adolf Hitler anymore at home, or marching in front of his store giving speeches about the imposter who had taken his place in Germany. So, we need to have different auxiliary egos in our lives, you know, a spouse, a friend, a sibling, people who help us in different ways. And that's the same notion that he had in group therapy.
So it wasn't trying to convince this guy he wasn't Adolf Hitler. It was really creating Adolf Hitler's world and almost sort of having him live it out.
Having him live it out, having him also helping him to find a new way of living, a different role. Well, you've played this role. Now what about, how about the butcher Fred from Yorkville in Manhattan? What's he like? Introduce us to him. That was very clever, and it was, of course, incredibly unorthodox in a world, really dominated by psychoanalysis.
Yes.
But this idea of role-playing did catch on. Now, remember, my dad was doing this in the teens, 20s, and 30s. Humanistic psychology, gestalt psychology, gestalt therapy, people like Abe Maslow, Carl Rogers, all these things came along in the late 40s and 50s and 60s.
You write about your dad being a child, I think he's about 4 years old, doing this thing he called God playing. And this really, frankly, shows up all through your book, and it seems his life as well.
He always got in trouble for this.
Yeah.
You can imagine. He said that we're all fallen gods. The process of growing up is discovering that we're not the center of the universe. And so often we need to recapture the godlike aspects of being a little boy or girl, which often involves a sense that we can create the universe around us, that we have, not only are we the center of the cosmos, but if we're the center of it, and this is very important to him from a moral point of view, we're also responsible for everything. We are of cosmic responsibility. And so he said, you can't have it both ways. Either we are nothing or we're everything. To him, it was what the logicians call two values. Either it's meaningless and then we should protest. Or if it has meaning, it must mean everything, and we must mean everything.
Well, and we all know people who think they are the center of the universe without any of the humility that goes along with that.
Well, that's the humility is a critical, and the sense of moral responsibility and caring about others. And you know, you're not writing rules just for yourself.
Right.
You're helping everybody else to find their way.
You write, Freud would have interpreted JL's God playing as an expression of his narcissism and megalomania.
Well, and he said, my dad often said, he admitted, he copped to his megalomania. It became a cliche. He would go to conferences and give lectures, and somebody would say, Dr. Moreno, this is like the 1940s, 1950s, is it true you think you're God? And on more than one occasion, he said, well, yes, I do. And there would be gasps of the psychiatrist and the psychologist. Well, he was tweaking them, you know. He wanted to see if they had a sense of irony. My dad thought that, in general, academics have no sense of humor. They're pretty boring, which is why he never wanted to be a full-time professor. And then he said, after things calmed down, he would say, well, so should you. Why would you settle for anything less?
Did he play God with you, his son?
I have to say he didn't, though he was probably looking at me a little bit as the new prophet.
Ah.
A role that I wasn't particularly interested in, ultimately. But he didn't impose it on me, I have to say. He was not cut out to be a traditional father. He was by no means a traditional father. But he was excellent in emergencies. Most of the time, he was thinking about how to save the world. Never learned how to drive. Very eccentric. Very colorful. And as I said, also very controversial in his field.
You describe, I think, traveling in Europe with him and all the sort of garb he was dressed up.
Well,
in.
He was always in a
very
in a,
theatrical. I guess,
very
right?
theatrical. Look, he was an old 19th century man, basically born in 1889. Right, so. He always wore, as he got older, always a bow tie, a white shirt, and a dark suit, and often a little hat. And one time, some teenage girls came up to him in London. We were on the street when I was a kid, and they said, oh, you were wonderful, because he looks so like theatrical. You were wonderful in your last movie. And he looked at them and said, yes, I was good, wasn't I? And they were so thrilled, and they didn't know, I don't think, who exactly they met. But they were very happy to have met him.
You also have a scene where I guess he's in a park and telling stories and kids just gravitating towards your father.
He started out as a storyteller in the gardens of Vienna, probably 1910 or so. And that's when he told stories and then he had them tell stories. And he noticed that they were natural role players, or part of the way he got the idea of role playing. And there was a fellow who was painting picture postcards that we would often see in the park for a few pfennig, you know. Very raggedly dressed, and this fellow came up to him and said, I've been seeing what you've done with the children. It's very interesting. Well, that was Adolf Hitler, who had been...
The real Adolf Hitler.
Yes, the real Adolf Hitler, the actual Adolf Hitler, who had been denied admission to the painting school, the art school in Vienna. If he had been admitted, we wouldn't have had the catastrophe we'd had, perhaps. And then he said he saw him in Munich when he was traveling with his actors. In 1921, he saw him in a beer hall holding forth. And my dad said, actually, you know, he had a peculiar intensity, but otherwise it didn't strike him as he was not all that different from all the other radicals who were around at that time.
So what did your father think mental illness was? He probably didn't even use those words, but what was his view when people really kind of went off the rails?
Well, you know, he thought that we're sort of all on the same spectrum. We all hear voices, for example. Socrates said he heard a voice. He called it his demon, or his conscience. We all hear voices. The difference is that people who are mentally ill can't distinguish between their internal voices and what's going on outside of them. And we can, and again, through drama, by externalizing these voices, by embodying them in real therapy, other people and therapists or auxiliary egos, we could help them to relate to these voices and put them in a certain place. You may not never eliminate them, but you can at least put them in a box so that you can decide when they should come out and when they shouldn't. And that was a very common procedure that he used. Well, look, he called us everybody who was not classified as a mental patient a normotic.
Normotic.
We're all normotics. And that idea, by the way, that everybody is a normotic who doesn't happen to be a mental patient became very popular, in effect, in the 1960s in the human potential movement and the pop therapies that came out in the 50s and 60s, that everybody needs some exposure to some reflection in a protected environment.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Jonathan Moreno, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Impromptu Men, and it's about his father, J.L. Moreno, who was the father, if I can say, of psychodrama, encounter culture, and even the social networks that we use today. That's what our guest says, and he is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And if you want to join our conversation again, we'd love to hear from the psychologists, psychiatrists, people in the world of therapy to join our conversation, whether you use some of these techniques or not, what do you think about them. That phone number again, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Some of the things we talked about, the empty chair, there's also mirroring and doubling and, and role reversal. Take us through some of these techniques.
Well, so the idea of the mirror is, you know, you're in a job interview, and you're sitting in a certain way, a certain posture. Somebody will be asked to sit in front of you and show you your posture.
Mirror
so that you can actually mirror what you're doing. And that turns out to be more effective than seeing yourself in a mirror because it's too distracting. But seeing it embodied by somebody else, our posture, how, for example, what if our legs are crossed? Or what if we're reaching down into our sock while we're talking to this person that we're trying to get a job with? Then there's also the double, very important. The double is I'm having an encounter, say, in psychodrama with my wife, and it's pretty clear to the group that I'm not saying what I'm really thinking. Somebody could be asked to come up behind you and say, you know, what you know, what really bothers me about what you did yesterday or what you said at dinner, and so you can veto that. No, that's not really what I'm thinking. Another technique is, of course, the role reversal that Clint Eastwood didn't do that he could have done. So there are many of these techniques. The whole idea is to give somebody a 360 degree view, if you will, of where they are in this scene and what kind of new kinds of behaviors, what kinds of new roles could they take.
In preparing this interview, I was thinking about my youth in the 60s, actually living in West Philadelphia, and hearing and seeing psychodramas or people that called this whatever it was, psychodrama, usually lots of screaming, sometimes nakedness. Was this taking your dad's ideas and perverting them from your perspective?
Well, you know, because I came along when I did, I was 7 years old when he was 70 years old, and by then was the early 1960s, and his fame was receding. And his ideas had been picked apart by the culture. And it was difficult for him to know what to do with all of the attention that these new pop therapies were getting. Many of them, by the way, acknowledged his influence. People like Eric Byrne, who did what's called transactional analysis, Fritz Perls, others, Carl Rogers, the famous psychologist. But they came then in a later generation. And then you have the crazier stuff that you mentioned, nude encounter groups and so forth. And he was really, I think, caught in a dilemma because he wanted to have his priority recognized, but he didn't want to be identified with some of the stuff that was going on at that time. So that was really painful for him, I think.
He had some interesting ideas about groups and how people sort of operated in groups.
Right. In 1915, when he was a medic in a refugee camp during the First World War for the Austro-Hungarian Army, there were families being brought in from the East, refugees, and they were being put arbitrarily next to each other in certain kinds of housing arrangements, and they weren't getting along, the cultural differences, language differences, religious differences. He wrote to a ministry in Vienna and said, you know, really, we should be putting these people together according to what he called sociometric principles. Who chooses to live with whom, to work with whom, and so forth? He got actually an opportunity to implement that idea in the early 1930s. A national prison committee asked him to go into Sing Sing Prison in New York, and reform the relationships in the prison by seeing who wanted to be with whom in certain work situations and living situations and so forth. Then he did a big reform school, a girls' reform school.
Hudson, right?
The Hudson Training School for Girls, which was at the time a very famous place. And he did the same thing, and they had a big runaway epidemic at that time, and he reorganized it according to who wants to work with whom and live in what cottage with whom and study with whom. And then he also trained these girls who had no skills and were, in many cases, early 1930s, you know, had no literacy, how to play certain roles, like the role of the waitress that they'd nobody ever taught them before, so they might be able to get a job when they get out during the Depression. But what's really important about this is today is that he understood that there are invisible social networks. He called them social networks in the early 1930s. And he would make these maps he called sociograms. Now, if you go on, if you're on Facebook and you look at your Facebook friends map, it's now called a social graphic. So this idea of social media is based on the idea of social networks. And there are people in that world who recognize, and I talk about them, that he started this during the 1930s.
And working in Sing Sing, did it lead then to, essentially the sort of segregation of Sing Sing? Because perhaps whites want to be with blacks, Latinos with Latinos, that, you know, that like-minded people want to be together.
So that's where the therapy, group therapy or psychodrama comes in. Because why is it that you're isolated or that you're isolating this person? There, now we have the role reversal, right? So that's very important. He wanted to integrate the groups, not only racially, but socially and emotionally, get people connected to each other. If you just leave it as a popularity contest, then you do have segregation in all kinds of ways. And he was drastically opposed to that. There are people who claimed that some southern school districts used his sociometry in the 1950s as a rationale for segregating black and white children. And, of course, that wasn't what he wanted at all.
You note the fact that Ella Fitzgerald went to this Hudson Training School for Girls.
Yes.
It sounds like she had a pretty terrible time.
Time. Well, after Ella Fitzgerald died, it was revealed that she had been at Hudson, this reform school, in the early 30s, around the time that J.L. had been doing his work. And he never talked about this, but she said that the girls were abused, which is not all that surprising. In fact, there were two segregated cottages of black girls at Hudson. And I, you know, I tell this story, Marty, as you know, in the book. I talk about my dad, warts and all.
Yes.
For some reason, he and his team did not identify the abuse. Now, was it kept from them? He did say he ran into obstacles getting all the news from the school. And so it's entirely possible that it wasn't disclosed. They kept it a deep secret. Or it's also possible that, you know, to some extent, people didn't talk about these things in the 1930s.
We're almost having a break here, but did you learn things about your dad you didn't know?
You know, I don't think I learned anything that I essentially didn't know, except for one thing. His first wife was a woman named Beatrice Beecher, who helped him really get established in New York in the late 20s and early 30s in theater and in academic circles. And she was a descendant of Henry Ward Beecher and Harriet Beecher Stowe. She married him so he could become a citizen.
Oh,
he
really?
Claimed they had. He said they had a platonic marriage, and they divorced amicably in 1934, and she died a few years later of tuberculosis. Well, I went back, and I had my research assistant go back to the records, and we agreed that according to the records of the Beecher family, she died in 1970. So, you know,
family stories.
His was his way of psychodramatically, you know, putting her out of his life.
And that's Jonathan Moreno, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Again, we're talking about his new book about his father, the father of psychodrama. It's called Impromptu Man. We take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and also get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Studio in Caminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City, Philadelphia, supports WHYY and presents Open House October 25th. The accredited professional program curriculum comes to life during live model painting demonstrations by award-winning instructors. Opportunity for private tours of on-site faculty studios, time to talk with students, instructors, and alumni who are working in the arts, and information about the new integrated art studio major available with Chestnut Hill College. StudioInCaminati.org.
Waldron Mercy Academy, a private co-educational Catholic school, supports WHYY, offering childcare beginning at 3 months old, traditional pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds, kindergarten, Montessori pre-primary, and first through eighth grades. Waldron Mercy Academy is located on a 35-acre campus in Marion Station. To learn more, there's an open house on October 26th at noon, 610-664-9847 or waldronmercy.org. Waldron Mercy Academy, celebrating 90 years in mercy.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY and presents William Glackens, the first major exhibition of this Philadelphia-born artist in 50 years, opening November 8th with over 90 of Glackens' work, showcasing the breadth and spirit of a local artist who became America's tastemaker in modern art. On First Friday, November 7th, a vaudeville-themed opening party will celebrate Glackens' exhibition with cocktails, jazz, and circus performances. For tickets, barnesfoundation.org or 215-278-7200.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Jonathan Moreno about his father, J.L. Moreno. He is the founder of Psychodrama, a movement, a form of therapy that combines psychiatry and theater. It challenged some of the conventional notions about therapy in the 20th century, including the ideas of Sigmund Freud, but it also predated some of the humanist views of therapy as well. Moreno also developed the study of social relationships, something that he called sociometry. And our guest, Jonathan Moreno, says his father also laid the foundation for today's social media, things like Facebook and Twitter. The book is called Impromptu Man. And again, we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscoane. What do you think of these ideas? Let me get Jasmine from, looks like Ardmore, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jasmine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hiya.
Hi there.
I'm curious about what you think that social media has done for society in large in terms of the psychodrama. It seems that JL's work was stunted by the intentional performers that he was working with, the actors at first, and then he had more success with like the average Joes, and that he preferred to kind of work in that environment. But social media kind of empowers every citizen as a performer to like craft their own mask, and I'm curious about what you think that does for, I guess, psychodrama for society at large and, like, what that means today.
Oh, Jasmine, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, John.
That's a fantastic question.
It is.
In 1934, my dad started a company he called Therapeutic Motion Pictures. He wanted to get psychotherapy out for the masses. No true therapy, he said, can have less of an object than the whole of mankind. And at the same time, he was worried about technology because he thought the technology could stunt our spontaneity. So you have this dilemma, right? I think he would have seen internet-based social media as a terrific opportunity to bring everybody, as you said, into the conversation. However, it's also an opportunity for cyberbullying, right, for example, right, and to create misunderstanding. So and I think he would have been fascinated. He would have seen it in many ways as the logical outcome of what he wanted to do with he never figured out how to do with cinema and with television. But at the same time, he would have said, you know, technology is always with us. We're going to have to learn how to live with it, but it has its downside too. So it's not perfect.
Well, and I mean, there's a lot of role playing that goes on in social media, doesn't it?
Indeed, and it is an opportunity to play roles and to reinvent yourself. I mean, what you do on Facebook, for example, is, you know, you are doing what psychologists call impression management. You know, you're putting out what you want to put out, and then Facebook now has this sort of problem about, you know, should it do any experiments or should it manage what you're seeing other people putting on your page, which is really interesting. So, yes, it is absolutely a form of virtual role-playing, no question about it.
Jasmine made a reference to the fact that he seemed to have a very sort of open view of people, didn't see, you know, the doctors up here and everyone else down there. He also did some really interesting, sounds like, research with prostitutes early on in his career.
Yes, when he was in Vienna, there were many, many prostitutes in Vienna in the teens. It was one of the few ways that, you know, a woman who wasn't married or a nun could make some money. But there was tremendous hypocrisy also about prostitution. So he saw a young woman in the afternoon being harassed in the gardens by a policeman, very brightly dressed, and he pulled her with him, took her roughly by the arm, and my father, you know, was annoyed and got his back up and wanted to follow them. Ultimately, turned out she was a sex worker who should not have been in the parks at that time of day. He decided to create what he would have called a self-help group of sex workers. He found them a gynecologist to give them exams, found them a lawyer. They had a big meeting. He and the gynecologist were on the dais with the leadership of this new self-help group in Vienna, these sex workers. And the first official act of this group was to throw the men out, which he thought was fantastic.
Good for them. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
So... Yeah, I mean, he wanted to go into this. He did see himself in something like an Old Testament prophet who went into the streets, who went into the marketplace, into the agora, and encountered people. His famous poem, 1914, Invitation to an Encounter. And that was sort of the beginning of the idea of the face-to-face encounter. Martin Buber picked that up about 10 years later. And it's become it's so deep in our culture now, authenticity, being real with each other. It is so deep that we don't even ask ourselves where it came from anymore. But it is actually a 20th century development.
I was telling you off the air, but I'll say it on the air. There, years ago, I took some acting classes for a couple of years, and it was the best therapy I ever got. No. In terms of, I mean, it's about role playing, obviously. It's about being authentic in that role that you're playing. It's about looking inside for the demons and the hurts, and it was absolutely fascinating.
And techniques are often compared with Stanislavski and method acting, and people like Al Pacino, who's a method actor, for example. And these method actors will talk about finding the truth in a role. And it may seem odd to our ear, right? You're not playing your own role, you're playing someone else's role. And my dad, in fact, would have said, no, actually, you should play Al Pacino.
Yes, exactly.
Nonetheless, there is a part of us in these roles that we can express and we can find, and this is the goal of method acting, is you can find what you identify with in that role.
Did he ever act, he himself? I mean, he was interested in the theater, but did he ever go on stage and perform?
Interestingly, he never acted. He was always the director. He always took the role of the director, the god, yes. Nobody else could ever direct J.L. in a psychodrama.
And how about for you? As you said, you used to, I guess, run some psychodrama?
I did psychodrama training, and as a kid, we did a lot of psychodrama and role reversal. If I wasn't eating my dinner, and I'm sure parents do this, my mother would say, all right, well... I'll be Jonathan, and as my mom, I would say, Jonathan, you really need to eat. You're a little boy. You need your meal. You need to eat. And and I would then see things from the mother's point of view. Her concern,
you played your mother. Your mother played you.
Yes, and then she would say, well, Mom, I really don't want to eat tonight. Can I wait an hour? And as my mother said, okay, you could wait an hour. Jonathan, come back in an hour when you're really hungry. You can work.
It worked, right?
It works. Sometimes it works.
You have at the end of your book of a kind of a back and forth that you have with your father, who died a number of years ago. But
yes.
it's you in conversation, sort of the same kind of conversation you just described with your mom.
Yeah, he was very critical of psychoanalysts who analyzed historical figures after they were long gone. He thought that was unfair. So I could have been accused of the same thing, I say some critical things about him. So I thought at the very least I should have a as best I can, write two pages without thinking about it too much. I didn't actually know how long it was going to be. It turned out to be two pages. And I really just did it straight. People may not believe me, but I really did just write it out and send it to my daughter instantly so she could verify it. And it was a way for me to roll reverse with him, from the cosmos. How would he have seen what I've done?
Well, and this is then you playing him or him playing you. I'm not sure. Toward the end of your life, you decided that your self-confidence wasn't always a big advantage. So self-confidence can look like...
It can look like being self-centered, narcissistic, and megalomaniac, and all these things he probably would have said he was, and he didn't. He had an idée fixe. He really thought for so many years, he was right, and he was the first in so many ways, and he had to fight hard against the psychoanalysts in particular in the 20s and 30s and 40s. He would literally be laughed out of a room if he tried to do psychodrama at some professional meetings.
Wow.
And he said, it took me toward the end of my life to realize that I really owed other people a debt of gratitude, because they carried forward what I was trying to do.
So you see his fingerprints on, I guess, Esalen, Est, Human Potential Movement, all of that.
There's no doubt. Psychodrama became part of the Human Potential Movement in the 1960s. Often these techniques were adopted, and they weren't identified as coming from psychodrama. People who wrote books about the Human Potential Movement would always cite psychodrama and do interviews with him and so forth. His style was no longer hip in the 1960s. He was this portly Viennese gentleman with sandy hair and blue eyes, and he had the accent. And this was all very exotic and lovely for many years. If a woman would come into the room, he would immediately kiss her hand.
Oh, goodness. Wow.
And he would hold her hand while he was talking to her. You know, this didn't really go over well. People misinterpreted it. It wasn't seductive. He was trying to establish a physical connection. If you see old, there are videos of him working with mental patients, and he will hold their hands, men or women, maintain a physical contact.
Well, in fact, I would love to have you read a very near the end of your book here, and perhaps you can set it up. But it's a beautiful description of him, I guess, at work.
He had an intense identification with his patients, and so this incident took place in 1972, less than 2 years before he died. And a former patient, he'd by then closed his hospital a few years before that because he couldn't afford the insurance anymore. But a former patient, a woman, called him and said that she was in a large mental hospital not far from Beacon, not from our house. And he said, well, I would like to come and see you. So he called a young man named Joe Powers, who's now a very distinguished psychotherapist who runs the group therapy programs at McLean Hospital, which is part of Harvard. And Joe wrote me this incident. He said that he took him to the hospital. And he said they walked into the day room where the patients were hanging out. And this is before all the big hospitals were deinstitutionalized, of course, 1972. So these people get there for weeks or months or years in some cases. He writes that jail was completely comfortable and was warmly inquiring how his former patient was and how her treatment was progressing. That particular tableau in itself was enjoyable to watch, but what followed was very mind-blowing. As he talked with her, slowly other patients drew near to him and began to sit on the couch, sit on the floor, at his feet, or to draw chairs near to him. He introduced himself to this growing group, shaking their hands, listening to each, patting their hands, smiling and reassuring. His charisma and therapeutic engagement were remarkable. I, a witness from 10 paces away. As a young man and a student who was learning about group work, I was amazed at how he related so comfortably with all the patients, how he addressed them, how he engaged them, and how attuned he was to the whole group. He was completely comfortable in living in the moment. He was completely comfortable with a group of acutely ill patients. He showed no discomfort with psychopathology. On the contrary, he exemplified compassion, empathy, and encouragement to all who joined him in this group encounter.
I underline that because it's, first of all, such a powerful scene, but it tells us so much about him, about his warm-heartedness, also his comfort with people who, you know, probably to a lot of other people would make them extremely uncomfortable.
He had a deep appreciation for human suffering. And look, there are many people who do. But unlike so many of the analytically trained psychiatrists of the day, he was prepared to immerse himself in the suffering, to identify with it and to work with them to try to find a way out. And that's what allowed him to have this special rapport, which to some extent you can't train this in people. You know, in a certain sense, either you've got it or you're not. In truth, also it was also part of his messianic style. He really thought that he could be he could save everybody. He also thought that everybody was a genius until proven otherwise. He often said that. You know, QED. Let's start by assuming that everybody is not crazy, and everybody is brilliant and hyper creative, and let's find ways to create outlets for this creativity. This is a very common notion today, but again, I emphasize this was not common in the teens and 20s and 30s. These were radically new ideas.
Is this how he raised you? I mean, that you were full of creativity and he was, and goodness?
He was completely encouraging. Of course, he was an older father at that point, it was kind of hard to rein in, it's hard to rein a little boy growing up in the country anyway. I would say whatever I did was fine with him. He did want me to go to medical school. I didn't. There were some things he wanted me to do that I didn't do, but he didn't push me in a dynastic way.
You describe early on in the book, this is growing up on the grounds of this mental institution, hearing, I think the patient's name was Joe,
yeah.
Sort of the sort of wailing of a patient that almost seemed like the music of some of your childhood.
It was the music of my childhood, it's very well put. This is a man who came as a young man in 1949, and he was not well. He had schizophrenia, but he was improving, and he would go with my dad to his psychodrama sessions in New York and so forth. And then, as I explained, a stupid uncle took him to see a prostitute, and he couldn't perform, and then he descended into an endless schizophrenic break. And my father kept his license in the hospital for another 18, 17 years because he didn't want to let Joe go. He felt
really?
So
he was
guilty.
That
he felt completely guilt-ridden that he had made this mistake and let Joe out. So, but Joe would wail. He would wail and wail and
all
wail.
Day long?
All day long. He was in a quiet room. There was a television on the other side of some bars so he could watch television. But he would come out with an attendant, and we'd walk around and walk around with him, and he was a danger to absolutely nobody. He was a danger to nobody but himself. And my friends would come, and the first time they'd come to play, because we had 20 acres and lots of room to play, they'd hear this, and they'd, what the heck is that? Mm-hmm. And, oh, that's Joe, you know. We'll say we're 11, 12 years old, and, you know, and they'd, oh, okay. You know, so the next time they came, Joe's wailing was just part of the music, as you say, of my childhood and of my play dates at a certain point.
Was this is this book attempt to rehabilitate your father or to put his name perhaps in front of the word psychodrama?
You know, it's true that many of the books that I've looked at mention psychodrama and don't mention him. It's a way to mainly it's a way to show that these disparate ideas that we improvisational theater, you know, groups, social networks are actually connected to each other. As your caller kind of got it, I think, very well. And we don't think of these ideas that way. But yes, I would say it's also an attempt to show that this is a really interesting, colorful person who deserves some credit for what he did before so many other people were taking pieces of it and doing great things with it. No problem with that. But a guy who needs to be remembered.
Well, Jonathan Moreno, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. You're welcome. The book is called Impromptu, J.L. Moreno and the Origins of Psychodrama in Counterculture and the Social Network. Our guest is a professor of ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, a member of the UNESCO International Bioethics Committee, and a senior fellow at this Center for American Progress. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can download podcasts of the show and much more. Kevin Griffin and Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Quinn Lipson is our intern this fall, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.